KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On our show today, we'll hear first from John Pfeffer on how progressives can use societal ills exposed by the pandemic to build a better world. Then we'll take a look at the history of immigrant detention in the United States, as told in a new book, Forever Prisoners. That's coming up in just a moment. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The coronavirus pandemic has been a devastating blow to countries, societies, communities, families, children, the elderly, and everyone in between. With nearly 500,000 deaths in the past year in the United States alone, the crisis is akin to a near-death experience for our society. Assuming we survive, should we not take stock of what is needed to happen in order to minimize the damage so that the next time we'll be better prepared? Or better yet, shouldn't we ensure that there is no next time? In a new book called Pandemic Pivot, my guest John Pfeffer has called together the work of a group of global progressive thinkers and experts who examined how our current systems failed us and what we can do to fix them. John Pfeffer is Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is the author of Aftershock, A Journey into Eastern Europe's Broken Dreams, and the Splinterlands Trilogy. He joins me to discuss Pandemic Pivot, a report from the Institute for Policy Studies, the Transnational Institute, and Focus on the Global South. Welcome to the program, John.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
So first, tell me how this book came about. This is the sort of collective work of a number of thinkers, and you've written a report based on discussions that took place last year?
That's correct. Back in the spring, we realized at the Institute for Policy Studies that there was really no going back to the status quo that existed prior to the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic. In other words, the situation prior to the pandemic was a pretty lousy situation if you take into account the economic inequality, the risk of climate crisis, et cetera. And so we wanted to talk to people around the world about how we could use this terrible situation to pivot to an entirely different kind of global economy, global society, US foreign policy, et cetera. And so we brought together people to have discussions along eight different issue areas. And out of that, we produced this book.
And those issue areas include things like the economy, like climate change, et cetera, right? And also the immigration crisis, the issue around authoritarianism, right? The rise of right-wing authoritarianism. So all of these trends that it seems as though were already in place before the coronavirus crisis that either became exacerbated during the crisis or were part of the reason why we saw the crisis, right?
That's correct. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the trends away from democracy that have been taking place over the last decade, the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, in many cases, merely accelerated those trends. So for instance, we saw dictators consolidating their power using the coronavirus as an excuse. And even in democratic societies, we saw leaders like Donald Trump use the coronavirus to exercise his executive authority or to push through an agenda that hitherto had been difficult to push through. For instance, on immigration, we saw tremendous setbacks, progressive setbacks on immigration questions as the Trump administration pushed through its agenda of basically shutting down all immigration and asylum seekers.
So we have many sort of social experiments that have been taking place around the world over the past year because, of course, the pandemic hit different countries in different ways, depending upon the conditions in that country, the response to the crisis, the way in which the governments worked to mitigate it. We had different responses. What are some of the lessons? And we've been covering this on our program, looking at, for example, what did New Zealand do right? What did South Korea do that was that worked for them, et cetera? So what were some of those lessons that you draw on in looking at how countries worked in successful ways to, make a crisis, to minimize a crisis that could have been much worse for them?
Well, the first is that the countries that have been successful largely put forward coordinated national responses. So here in the United States, obviously, we had a patchwork of responses from the federal government, from different states, local authorities. But the countries that were successful, South Korea, Taiwan, New Zealand, as you mentioned, were very effective in coordinating a top-down federal approach or coordinated national approach. That's the first lesson. The second was to really respond very quickly with the technology at hand. And that we saw, for instance, in South Korea with a very robust testing and tracing system that was put in place, as well as technology such as cell phone apps that could help individuals participate in that system. The third was compliance. Here, obviously, in the United States, we've had a large number of people in the country who have simply refused to comply with face mask wearing or gathering in large public meetings. But in the countries that were successful, we saw large percentage of the population, overwhelming percentage, comply with the requirements of dealing with this pandemic. And those were, not compliance that was dictated by the state. This was compliance that really came from the bottom up. That was certainly the case in New Zealand, certainly the case in South Korea.
Which speaks to both a cultural difference in the nation, but also the moral authority from leaders. So I want to sort of step back and give me a sense of who these thinkers were whose work you reported on. You write in your book that last summer, the Institute for Policy Studies invited 68 of the world's leading thinkers and activists to participate in 8 in-depth discussions on Zoom. So these weren't just Americans, right? Who were they? Give me a sense of them.
Sure. Well, many of them were leaders of civil society organizations, like Kumba Touré, who's the head of Africa Rising in Africa. She's in Senegal. Or Walden Bella, a sociologist who was founder of Focus on the Global South, which is based in Bangkok in Thailand. But we drew on a variety of different journalists, academics, thinkers, even some policymakers who have been involved in international authorities like the UN, in order to try to bring as much kind of information to the table, as much experience to the table as possible when crafting, well, first of all, when analyzing the situation, trying to figure out, well, how did this go wrong? Why did we respond as a globe so poorly to the COVID crisis compared to, say, SARS or MERS, the previous pandemics? And then once we've kind of figured out the problems, to identify, well, where can we go in different directions? What are the kinds of policy changes we should make, bearing in mind that we're in a very different situation today than we were prior to the onset of this pandemic? So for instance, prior to the pandemic, it would have been very difficult to imagine stimulus package here in the United States of the size that were pushed through during the Trump years, and which is being considered right now in the Biden administration. That kind of magnitude of spending was not on the table. But now that it's on the table, well, can we consider something of equal magnitude when thinking about a Green New Deal, for instance? So the pandemic has, in some ways, opened up certain policy options that were simply not available previously.
One of the things that came about that was just such an important illustration of what economic stimulus can do last year was when the CARES Act passed, and Americans who were struggling, who were unemployed, were able to get $600 a week, the equivalent of $15 an hour if they worked 40 hours a week. And you know, and because you know, for those people who are unemployed from the pandemic, that had a pretty significant impact, not just on individuals, but on our economy as well, right? Because people could actually buy the things that they needed or pay off the things that they needed to pay off and survive. They didn't fall through the cracks. It helped buoy small businesses. That was a really good illustration of what is possible, say, when in post-pandemic times, we simply have a $15 an hour minimum wage.
I think that's a very good point. But we could also look to what European countries did, or many European countries did, when the pandemic hit. And that was to step in and actually cover the salaries of people in the workplaces, so they didn't have to be unemployed at all. And in fact, what the European Union did as a collective entity in with their stimulus package, which really sought not just to kind of deal with the problem as is, but also sought to reduce the inequalities that had cropped up between countries in the European Union. So a large amount of the EU stimulus package, the bailout package, was in the form of grants and went to the hardest hit countries like Italy and Spain. So this is an opportunity because we recognize that the coronavirus has really sharpened economic inequalities both within countries and between countries. This is an opportunity with our economic responses to address that economic inequality. And the $15 an hour minimum wage, I think, is an excellent example that you bring up.
Let's talk about the Green New Deal with the situation, you know, very rapidly being apparent that we are in the midst of climate change. As you and I speak, of course, the southern United States is in the throes of a very severe winter storm, and our current energy systems are unable to handle it. Fossil fuel pipelines have, you know, frozen, and millions of people are without power. People have already died. There are people trying to warm themselves by running their car in the garage and dying of carbon monoxide poisoning. It's quite tragic to see this unfold in the world's richest country, something we're utterly unprepared for, just as we were utterly unprepared for a pandemic that experts knew would come. So how significant is this idea? And what did the experts that you report on say about a Green New Deal, an idea that seems to address multiple crises in a very elegant manner?
Yes. And as you pointed out at the top of the show, the pandemic in many ways is a wake-up call. It's a recognition that we face an existential crisis, a global crisis as a planet. That's COVID-19, but it's also climate change. And as you mentioned, all of these things that are happening right now in the United States are happening now, and they're happening here. This is very different from what people have said in the past, that, you know, the climate crisis is something that happens to other places, to other countries, to small islands, or it will happen sometime in the future, and we don't really have to worry about it right now. But it is clearly a pressing problem, and it's a pressing problem here. The Green New Deal is something that is being offered, you know, it was offered in Congress by the Democrats, and it has been offered in other countries as well as a way of preemptively dealing with the climate crisis by saying, look, we have to put a lot of money into shifting our economies to clean energy, and we can't just do that by economic fiat. We have to really think this through carefully, how we can kind of shift our workforce away from dirty technologies, coal mining, oil and gas production, shift them to solar energy production, clean electricity production, to do so in a way that addresses some of the other problems in our society as well. For instance, the fact that our infrastructure throughout the United States, our roads, our public transportation, our buildings are in terrible repair. So this is an opportunity to kind of apply funds and work to remedying that situation. So the Green New Deal is both a job creation opportunity, a way of shifting away from dirty energy, but also a way of, in many ways, renewing this country. And we see this in other countries as well, where Green New Deals have been offered, whether it's in the European Union or South Korea, and all toward ultimately the ultimate goal, which is shrinking carbon footprints, which we haven't really accomplished, even though we said we would do so as a result of the Paris Climate Accords. But 5 years later, we have not seen any significant shrinkage of these carbon footprints. And that has to happen immediately and in an accelerated fashion moving forward.
Let's talk about what I think might be our biggest global challenge that also impacts individual nations in a way that's perhaps, you know, incomparable, which is right-wing authoritarianism, the opposition to a Green New Deal, the opposition to a minimum wage, the opposition to the Paris Accord are all rooted in the same forces that we saw manifested on January 6th here in the United States, in the Trump presidency as a whole. I mean, you see, you know, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas denouncing the Green New Deal because Texas is experiencing a power outage. There doesn't even have to be a truthful basis for their claims. Right-wing attacks on progressive policies that can benefit all of us have really hampered any progress in the right direction. So what did the experts that you report on say about countering radical right-wing authoritarianism? You know, Joe Biden can't even definitively push for a federal minimum wage. This Tuesday at the town hall meeting on CNN, when asked about the importance of raising the wage, he said, yes, but we should really understand that small businesses are also going to have trouble. He can't even agree to canceling $50,000 of college debt and says, oh, he has the authority to do it for $10,000, but not $50,000. So the opposition to right-wing authoritarianism is so weak. So I feel like this is our biggest crisis.
I think you're right. And, you know, our experts identified basically a common denominator, which is a denialism, a denialism that the COVID-19 is a real pandemic, that the climate crisis is a real crisis. You know, this denialism even spreads to, conceptions of society, a denial of demographic realities on the ground here in the United States, that this country is becoming less dominated by white people. And that's a demographic reality moving forward. So these denialisms kind of are across the board. In terms of responses, those vary. I mean, obviously, to address the far right, it's necessary to deal with both their an underlying concern that has kind of fueled support for populism, right-wing populism, and that is, a certain amount of anxiety around economic globalization and the fact that people will and have lost jobs as a result of manufacturing moving overseas and other and the financialization of the economy. So addressing these economic issues is absolutely paramount for any progressive force. Second is to address kind of the digital propagation of far-right ideology. And we've seen the effectiveness of deplatforming, in other words, removing far-right voices from Facebook and from Twitter. You know, the removal of Donald Trump, the removal of QAnon really reduced the amount of misinformation and disinformation that was out there on the web. So those are two kind of important strategies moving forward. Obviously, we would want to see greater strengthening of democratic institutions in general, both here in the United States and globally. We would want to see greater international cooperation that would, kind of knock the legs out from under these right-wing populists. So there are a variety of different strategies I think we have to look at.
When we look at how the right-wing authoritarian response to immigration has been so devastating here in the United States, really resulted in the dehumanization, particularly of brown people, what are some lessons from other parts of the world? Even before, well before the pandemic, we did have a crisis around immigration because, of course, people, large swaths of people in many different parts of the world, we're fleeing war, we're fleeing poverty, we're fleeing violence, much of it fomented by the rich nations that they were fleeing to. We see it not just at the US-Mexico border, we've seen it in Europe, across the Mediterranean, from the global south to European nations. So what did we see, first of all, transpiring, in terms of how governments responded to the pandemic and scapegoated immigrants? We know in the U.S. here, Trump did that. He claimed that immigrants would be, because of the pandemic, we've got to attack immigration. Did we see that in Europe as well? And what were some positive responses on immigration?
Well, first of all, we saw, unfortunately, kind of the realization of many of the far right's demands on immigration immediately after the pandemic hit, and that was basically shutting down borders. And that happened pretty much across the board, not just here in the United States, but throughout Europe, throughout the global south as well. So that was an unfortunate occurrence, obviously. But one of the unusual kind of side effects of that is it removed immigration as a political issue for the right wing. And so the right wing started to look at some other questions. And I would argue that one of the reasons why QAnon became so popular as a conspiracy theory among the far right is because the immigration issue was no longer politically useful for them. In terms of positive things that we've seen, we did see, for instance, a country like Portugal extending its healthcare services to immigrants. We saw the importance of Thailand, which had extended its, even prior to the pandemic, extended healthcare to all members of the country, whether they were immigrants or undocumented or else. And the pandemic has had virtually no impact on Thailand as a country. I mean, very, very few deaths several dozen. So really important message to us about the importance of healthcare in general as a preventive tool against pandemics.
And then recently we also saw France has fast-tracked citizenship processes for immigrants that have been working in the health field and, you know, doing such important life-risking work to keep the French safe. And France rewarded them with a fast track to citizenship. And we see here in the United States, immigrants form the backbone of so much of our health work. It would be amazing if we had that approach as well. Although Biden has talked about a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants and DACA recipients as well. In the practical sense, very little has changed so far, although it is early days. Do you think finally, John, that there will be enough of an appetite for us to change things? I love the analogy that you open your book with, that, you know, you have a heart attack. If you survive it, the most sensible thing you can do is to look back on your lifestyle, think about all of the behaviors that led to you having a heart attack that are within your control, and you know, the right thing would be to change those lifestyle issues so that you are a healthier person. As a global society, will we change the conditions that led to the pandemic, that got worse during the pandemic? It seems like we're going to need a huge effort to do that. It was already a huge effort before the pandemic for progressives to make progress.
That's correct. And, you know, obviously people are very focused on, you know, the present, you know, ensuring that vaccines are distributed, that, you know, we achieve in a responsible way the herd immunity that will allow us to return to work. So obviously there's a desire to get back to some version of the status quo. I think it will take a little bit longer for people to realize that that status quo is simply unsustainable. Some people obviously already realize that, the folks who have been being hit by, you know, this extreme climate conditions around the world, or by being hit by, you know, the border restrictions, or being hit by economic inequality. So obviously though, people who have already or are already experiencing these crisis situations apart from the pandemic are very clued into the fact that the status quo is unsustainable. The rest, I think we will have to, you know, really push a little harder to get the necessary legislative changes, to get the popular movements that are really necessary to get those legislation through the Congress. And that's going to require organizing, as it always has. And, you know, once we get out of this pandemic situation, I think organizing will be a little easier. I mean, it's a little hard to actually, you know, organize stuff by Zoom. Once we can gather safely, I think we progressives will have an easier time, you know, pushing for a new status quo.
I want to hone in on the word pivot, which is in the title of your book. You know, the wealthy right-wing elites have taken actions that Naomi Klein characterized as the shock doctrine, taking advantage of societies in crisis. And I'm sure already there are forces working to do that. But there can be pushback from the left, pivoting away from, you know, from the conditions that led to the crisis. Would you say something like the New Deal, when FDR responded to the Great Depression with the New Deal, was the kind of pivot that you're hoping for here, which does point to the need for really good leadership?
Absolutely. I mean, the possibility of a pivot here with a Green New Deal basically being the New Deal of our times, I think, is a very good possibility. Another possibility, let's just mention
the, I'm hard-pressed to think that Biden is the one who has what it takes to lead us into that. He just seems so reluctant to take bold action.
Well, you know, that is our responsibility to push him towards that. And you know, to a certain extent, his lack of an economic vision beyond, you know, some rote phrases is an opportunity to kind of pour our economic vision into his, you know, receptacle, if you will. But another example would be the crushing debt that so many countries around the world face. And the coronavirus has only aggravated that. But, you know, here's an opportunity to really change the terms of the debate. I mean, previously it was like some debt extensions and, you know, maybe an increase in special drawing rights at the IMF. But here's an opportunity to really transform the debate on debt to, for instance, debt climate swaps, in which countries around the world are able to use the money that they would have spent for debt servicing to really build up their sustainability, to move from away from dirty industries to preserving forests and biological diversity. So here's a real opportunity for a pivot at a global scale that addresses the most vulnerable countries, not just the middle class or the well-off countries that will, you know, probably recover reasonably quickly from this pandemic, but the ones that are most hard-pressed by this pandemic. And this is an opportunity for that kind of pivot as well.
John, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
My guest has been John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. And we've been discussing his new book, Pandemic Pivot, a report from the Institute for Policy Studies, the Transnational Institute, and Focus on the Global South. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Trump administration's immigrant family separation brought to light the horrors of the U.S.'s imprisonment of immigrants. But most Americans might be unaware that immigrant detention has a long and sordid history in the United States, going back as far as the late 19th century. Many have challenged the application of the U.S. Constitution to non-citizens, thereby greatly limiting the ability of those incarcerated to advocate for themselves and have any recourse for justice or freedom. Writing about the history of immigrant detention in a new book is Elliot Young. He's a professor in the history department at Lewis and Clark College, the author of Alienation, Chinese Migration in the Americas from the Coolie Era through World War II, and Catarino Garza's Revolution on the Texas-Mexico Border. He's also the co-editor of Continental Crossroads, Remapping U.S.-Mexico Borderlands History, and the co-founder of the Tezpotlan Institute for Transnational History of the Americas. He's also provided expert witness testimony for over 200 asylum cases. He joins me to discuss his new book called Forever Prisoners: How the United States Made the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. Welcome to the program, Elliot.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So the words detention and imprisonment are not the same. We are told in the United States that when immigrants are held behind bars, they're not prisoners, they're not incarcerated, they're simply being detained. They're in the detention system. Is that really accurate? I mean, but for all intents and purposes, from the point of view of the person being detained, they are a prisoner, right?
Exactly. I mean, the law creates these fictions and creates these labels, and it goes stretches back to actually a Supreme Court decision in the late 19th century, 1893, where the Supreme Court decided that to detain, incarcerate an immigrant pending deportation was not imprisonment in the legal sense. And the important distinction here is that if it's not imprisonment in the legal sense, then the person being incarcerated does not have access to the same rights does not have a judicial trial and does not have access to a state-mandated lawyer.
So basically due process, which is what everybody who's officially incarcerated, formally incarcerated in the U.S. has.
Exactly. And we know that there are lots of problems with the people who are formally incarcerated in the criminal justice system. But this puts immigrants in an even more vulnerable position where they're not able to use the regular criminal justice system to fight for their rights. And as a result, throughout this 140-year history, many immigrants find themselves facing indefinite detention in these immigrant prisons. And I use that term knowing that it's not the technically right term, but in many cases, the places where immigrants are detained are in fact penitentiaries, they're prisons and jails. So the distinction is really lost on the immigrant.
Now, I recall that when the George W. Bush administration during the so-called War on Terror began holding enemy combatants, as they were called, in the Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba, that idea of, you know, labeling them as enemy combatants as opposed to prisoners allowed the United States to sidestep those constitutional rights of due process. And of course, we had a whole separate set of justice, military justice, that is still deeply broken for the Guantanamo prisoners. But that wasn't, of course, the first time that the United States incarcerated individuals without giving them rights. So let's go back to the history that you write about in your book. What are the origins of immigrant detention in the United States? How far back do they go?
Yeah, and I think, you know, many people today think about the so-called illegal alien, and it's the Mexican or the Central American. But really, this all starts in the end of the 19th century with the Chinese Exclusion Act, 1882, and with a bureaucracy that develops to try to stop Chinese laborers from coming into the country. And if they are in the country without authorization, to incarcerate and detain them. And so in the 1880s, what was happening is there were a series of pogroms along the Pacific coast in towns like Tacoma and Seattle. And Chinese were literally, by mobs of white men, many working class men, pushed out of the towns. They were being then picked up by local police, by marshals, and being sent to this prison on a remote island off the coast of Seattle called McNeil Island Prison. And what initially the authorities tried to do was to just bring them back to Canada, which is where they had come from. But Canada had a head tax for Chinese. And so if the Chinese were unable to pay the head tax, the Canadians refused to accept them. So they ended up back in McNeil Island Prison, piling up for years and years, the government not knowing what to do with them. Eventually in 1890, they started the first deportations all the way back to China. And this begins this process of more than 130 years of detentions and deportations.
So when you say forever prisoners, which is the title of your book, those who become incarcerated under this immigrant detention center that goes back to the late 19th century often don't know when their detention is going to end, right?
Yeah, and you sort of picked up on this inference or invocation of the Guantanamo prisoners, who were labeled by journalists as forever prisoners because many of them don't even have charges. They have not been convicted of anything, and yet they've been now more than two decades incarcerated in Guantanamo. And what you find is that immigrants over various periods find themselves in a very similar position where if they're not able to be deported, they have indeterminate sentences. This is unlike any other person who is in jail or prison. They know, you know, they have a certain number of years they have to serve and then they get out. For these immigrants, they are essentially facing indefinite detention and without the benefits of a judicial trial or the ability to question their liberty. So really, this strikes at the heart of everything that we know to be justice and due process.
So McNeil Island Prison, where Chinese immigrants were held for various infractions, did that, you know, what happened to it? And I understand that eventually it wasn't just Chinese immigrants, it was people from other countries that were held there as well, right?
Exactly. So first of all, it's not just, this was a regular prison, so people were picked up on criminal charges. And what you see happening as we get into the 20th century is increasingly more immigrants are being picked up on drug and alcohol charges. And so this might sort of echo what has been going on with mass incarceration, where there is an increasing policing of drugs in the so-called drug war that leads to mass incarceration. So the same kind of thing was happening in the early 20th century. And by the 1920s and 30s, it's largely Mexicans who are the biggest population of foreigners incarcerated in McNeil Island. So it goes from Chinese to Mexicans.
You highlight in your book the story of Cubans being held at McNeil Island Prison. Tell me that story.
Yeah, so in 1980, the largest boat lift in the history of the United States happened, where 125,000 Cubans fled Cuba to come to the United States. Unlike previous 1950s and 60s, where they had basically declared an end to detaining immigrants who arrived at seaports, in this case, and with the Haitians, who were largely poorer and darker skinned, they set up mass detention camps for them on military bases throughout the country. Many of them were paroled, almost all of them were paroled into the United States after a period of time in those mass detention camps. But some of them, before they could legalize their status, had committed low-level infractions, many for simply drug possession. So what happened is they served whatever time they had to serve for that charge, and then they became ineligible for asylum because of that drug charge or because of that criminal infraction. So they were sent directly to Atlanta Penitentiary, where they were being held, some of them, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. What happens is in 1987, the US government negotiates with Cuba to deport 2,000 of these Mariel Cuban refugees who have been sitting in prison pending deportation for years. The Cubans hear about this, they take over Atlanta Penitentiary, they take over a detention center in Oakdale, Louisiana, seize over 100 guards as hostages, torch the buildings, and demand that they have individual reviews of their cases because they actually have legitimate claims to asylum. The standoff ends after 2 weeks. One of the Cuban detainees was actually shot and killed by guards. And they do these individual reviews and end up deporting over 1,000 of them back to Cuba in the early 1990s. But what this episode shows is that by the 1980s, there has been this increasing meshing of immigration law on the one hand and criminal law on the other hand to capture immigrants who had committed, in many cases, low-level infractions and punish them with deportation, or in the case of the Cubans, where they couldn't deport them, with essentially perpetual imprisonment. Mm.
And of course, it costs the United States money to keep people in prison for indefinite periods. Before we get to other specifics from your book as an aside, what do you think has been the prevailing motivation from the United States government? Is it an ideological motivation to send a message? Is it one that reflects the sort of racial oppression that this nation was built on? Is it one of money and corporate interests or private prison interests? What is the motivation to keep people imprisoned, obviously at taxpayer expense, indefinitely?
Yeah, this is a tremendously expensive system. As we know now, immigration enforcement is by far the largest sort of expense in the federal criminal justice system. 70% of prosecutions are against people for entry and illegal entry. So I think it makes no sense from an economic point of view why they're doing this. I think largely it's ideological. It has to do with racism, with the initial reason why immigration restrictions were set up against the Chinese, later against Southern Europeans and Jews, against all Asians, of course, at the beginning of the 20th century, and then increasingly enforcement focused on Mexicans and other Latin Americans. And so I think it's the racist idea of trying to maintain the purity of a white ethnostate. And it's also this sense of preserving the rights of citizens by excluding this group of marginalized others, whether they be Black and brown citizens or non-citizens who also tend to be Black and brown.
So it's scapegoating, basically, right?
It's scapegoating, and it serves to, for some people to have this sense of, we have rights as Americans, but our rights need to be defined against the rightlessness of immigrants or these Black and brown citizens who get incarcerated and increasingly don't have rights. The one point I would want to mention in terms of economic motivation, certainly in terms of immigrant detention, where two-thirds of the immigrant detention centers are run by private corporations, there is an economic interest by those corporations to increasingly detain and incarcerate more and more immigrants. And we see lobbying by groups like GEO, who run the detention centers, to in fact increase enforcement and mandate a certain number of beds per day. And so there is definitely corporate economic interests that benefit and profit off of immigrant detention.
Going back to history and the specific stories you profile in your book, tell me about the story of Nathan Cohen, who you describe as a Russian Jewish Brazilian immigrant. What is his story? It's such a strange story. I'd never really heard of this before.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. So Nathan Cohen comes from a part of Russia that at that point is a borderlands region going back between Germany and Russia. He migrates to Brazil, spends a few years there, then comes to the United States, enters at Ellis Island, joins his family uncle who happens to be in rural Georgia. And he opens a business with his uncle. And this is, up till this point, it's kind of the typical story of like, lucky immigrant comes, opens a business, successful. Within a few months, his family defrauds him out of his business. His wife leaves him for his best friend. This sends him into a funk where he stops speaking, and he ends up being put into a mental hospital, what they called then an insane asylum. And the immigration authorities said, because you've been declared insane, that means you must have been insane when you arrived, and that means you should be deported. So they send him back to New York, put him on a ship, back to Brazil. In Brazil, the Brazilians say, we don't want nothing to do with this guy. We have no relationship with him. They try to land him in Argentina. Argentina refuses to accept him. So he gets sent back to New York, put in Ellis Island, incarcerated on Ellis Island for a few months. The government tries again to deport him. The same thing happens in Brazil. In the meantime, the press picks up on the story and they're referring to him as the wandering Jew, the man without a country. So this time when he comes back to New York Harbor, the government says, don't even let him off the boat, because they realize that once someone is let onto US soil, you actually have more rights than if you're considered to be outside of the country. And so he's essentially stuck on this boat in New York Harbor in this depression, and with the intervention of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid and Sheltering Society and a fraternal organization, they agreed to pay for his upkeep at a private sanitarium in Connecticut. So he gets off the ship, but within a year dies at that sanitarium. He's only in his mid-30s. Wow. And is buried in Staten Island. Mm-hmm. So it's a very sad case, but what that story pointed me to was discovering that by far the largest number of immigrants and also citizens incarcerated in the 20th century up to about the 1960s were in mental institutions and not in jails and prisons. It's only in the latter part of the 20th century that now those mental institutions have shrunk, and basically those same people end up in prisons and jails, which is why you have such a high number of people with mental illness in prisons and jails.
How has the immigration detention system grown in the US, and when was its largest period of growth? We know that the George W. Bush administration began detaining whole families that crossed the border. The Obama administration briefly, or to some extent, continued that. And then, of course, under the Trump administration, it exploded and they actually separated parents from children. And today we just have these pretty vast systems of immigrant detention in the United States. So where do you go back to point out the expansion or some sort of rapid expansion of immigrant detention? Or was it just a slow increase over time?
Well, it's more fits and starts. So going, you know, when the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed in 1882, there was no bureaucracy. They had to create a bureaucracy. And over time, you know, more and more funding went into immigration enforcement. But you get various periods where this explodes. In the 1930s, there's a whole so-called repatriation of Mexicans. So they have to beef up enforcement then. 1924, the Border Patrol gets established. 1950s, there's so-called Operation Wetback, where millions of Mexicans are picked up and sent back. So there is these periodic moments when the immigration system gets beefed up and increased. But really, in the last 20 to 30 years, we've seen the massive growth in terms of billions and billions of dollars being spent on enforcement and detention of immigrants. And looking, you know, at the last 20 to 30 years, you could see this is a bipartisan policy. Trump is extreme in his rhetoric, but Trump is in many ways continuing the policies of deportation using the machinery that was built up by Obama. And if you actually look at the numbers of immigrants that Obama deported was far higher than Trump was able to do. And so I think we have to understand that the Democrats have been as responsible for these policies as the Republicans.
And President Joe Biden now has moved to undo some of that damage, I suppose, realizing that what the Democrats did under Obama paved the way for Trump's most egregious anti-immigrant policies. He has pledged to reunite separated families and also moved to try to put a moratorium on deportation. But now we're seeing that a federal court in Texas apparently has blocked his moratorium on deportation. So we'll see how that goes. But moving forward in your book to a more contemporary story, you know, we talked about Nathan Cohen, who you write about, who died, and his story is more than 100 years old. What about the story of Mayra Machado? She is someone who you write about, and you talk about her in an age of crimmigration. What is this word, crimmigration, and who is Mayra Machado?
Yeah, so crimmigration is the overlapping or interlocking of immigration law and criminal law. And so this begins in the 1980s and really picks up in the 1990s under Clinton. And what you see with Mayra Machado's story, she is a Salvadoran who was brought to this country when she was 5 years old in 1990. Her mother was escaping the political violence, the civil war in El Salvador. She grows up as an American, speaking English in Southern California, ends up in Arkansas, and when she's 18 years old, writes a fraudulent check. So clearly committed a mistake, you know, did a mistake, went to court, they sentenced her to 6 months, or they sentenced her to 10 years of stacked charges, but gave her a suspended sentence of 6 months. So she did her time in a diversion program, and that would have been the end of it. That was 2005. What had happened, though, between 2005 and 2015, and especially under Obama, is they deputized local law enforcement to be immigration agents. So in 2015, when she was picked up on a traffic violation, like a failure to yield violation, she gets sent to the police station. And the police officer there is a local deputized ICE officer, runs her immigration information, finds out that she is undocumented and that she has this criminal charge. So she gets sent from Arkansas to Louisiana to ICE detention center and gets put into deportation proceedings. I was contacted at that point by a lawyer to work on her case as an expert witness about country conditions in El Salvador. She loses her struggle and gets deported in early 2017. In El Salvador, is facing sexual harassment threats by gangs as well as government officials. So she returns to the United States clandestinely, undocumented again. And after about a year, is picked up on another traffic violation and again gets sent to Louisiana as put into deportation proceedings. But this time it's illegal reentry, which carries an even greater punishment. So she, from the Louisiana Detention Center, is representing herself. She does not have a lawyer at this point, calls me up because she had my number when I previously worked on her case and asked if I would serve as an expert witness. And I agreed, got her a pro bono lawyer. We went down to Louisiana to the ICE Detention Center to the hearing, but she eventually loses that, and her case was appealed by the lawyer to the Fifth Circuit Court in 2020 in January, while her case is still pending. One night she's just picked up, shackled, put on a plane, and sent back to El Salvador. And so this case is represents what had happened in the 2000s with this interlocking of criminal law and immigration law that both criminalized migrants and as well as resulting in essentially what amounts to permanent banishment and separation from her three US citizen children who are living still in Arkansas. And so it's a tragic case. She's now living in San Salvador and working to actually reunite children in El Salvador with their parents in the United States.
Well, Elliot, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing information about your book. And I'm sure our audience will pick up copies and read it for themselves. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Elliot Young, a professor in the history department at Lewis and Clark College. We've been discussing his latest book, Forever Prisoners, How the United States Made the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar.
Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand